Matthew 7, verses 1 to 5. The 32nd talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew is presented by Ron Julian on July 30, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2017. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
We are supposed to be heading into the last part of chapter 6 of Matthew, but this passage is kind of the one passage in the Sermon on the Mount that I'm not entirely sure what I think is going on. This is the thing about the lilies of the field and that stuff, and you would think, what could be easier to preach on than, like, you know, the sparrows and the lilies of the field? And what is wrong with you, Ron? But I find it difficult to pin down exactly what's going on there. I think it's really easy, actually, to take that passage in directions that Jesus didn't intend. So I've decided to be weird and go out of order and go into chapter 7, which has the advantage, at least, that I know what I think about it. This is a very important passage. I hope that it's clear by the time that we're done. Somewhere along the line, I'm going to come back and do the lilies of the field part, I think. I'm not promising I'm doing it next week, because I just want to think about it. Maybe we can all get together when Jesus returns, and we can have a little class on the bank of the Jordan River, and I'll tell you, I finally decided what it is that's happening with that, and you'll all want to come, I'm sure. Okay, so Matthew 7. We're going to be looking at the first five verses. Do not judge, lest you be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. And why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Okay, so I'd kind of like to set up my comments here. There are, it seems to me, certain foundational truths in the Bible that undergird really everything that we're looking at, all of the stuff related to the gospel, certainly what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount. One of those truths is that God, our Creator, is going to judge us. I mean, that our destiny is in the hands of God. That's one of the foundational things from beginning to end, is that as human beings, our destiny is in the hands of God. Another one of those foundational truths is that we are evil people who stand condemned unless God is merciful. And finally, mercy only comes to those who have hearts with some certain quality that the Bible talks about. There is something that characterizes those that will receive the mercy of God and so find life. I mean, from beginning to end, it's clear it's just not an automatic pass. You don't just get in just because you're a person. There is a decision you have to make, and it arises out of what kind of person you are. Okay, so those are the foundational truths that we're building on here. It is not those who are free from sin. It's not that. It's not that we demonstrate that we now don't have any problem with evil in our lives and so God is merciful and lets us into the kingdom of God. That's not the picture. But it is a certain openness of heart to the truths of God. And you know the kind of thing I'm talking about, I think. It is hearts that acknowledge sin, gratefully accept God's mercy, believe God's promises of eternal life, and so on. It is that sort of person with that sort of heart that is going to ultimately find rescue from condemnation. The Sermon on the Mount has been rooted in these fundamental truths. I mean, if you've been with us here, that's just time after time. Everything we've looked at is exploring really that question of who is it that's going to find mercy on the day of judgment? What sort of hearts must we have to be welcomed into the kingdom of God? And that's what he's been talking about. That's the topic. So it's not surprising that this passage explicitly connects God's judgment with our attitude. Something about how we respond to things is going to be related to how God responds to us. That's not a surprising sort of idea. That's the Bible is filled with that, and Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount is filled with that. So I would like to set up where I'm going with this with an analogy that I have used many times, but I find it helpful. I like this analogy, and it will help me set up what it is I'm trying to say here. The Bible tells us that the two great commandments are to love God and to love our neighbors as ourselves. And the analogy that I like to use concerns the Ptolemaic versus the Copernican view of the solar system. In the old Ptolemaic view of the solar system, the explanation that was given depended on how things looked from where we are on the earth. You look up at the sky and you say, okay, what's going on? What do we see? We see the sun moving through the sky. It comes up in the east and moves through the sky and goes down in the west. And then we look at night and we see the planets moving. We see stars. We see planets that are kind of wandering around up there. So from our vantage point, it makes sense to say that the earth is at the center of the solar system and everything is moving around us because that's what we see. I'm standing here. Nothing's moving. I look. The sun is moving. The planets are moving. So from where I'm sitting, that's what's going on. Well, my analogy there is that's kind of like how we, by nature, view God and each other. I am here in my body, looking out my eyes with my thoughts and my feelings and my sensations and my desires. So God, like the sun, I mean, it's big, hard to miss him, he's out there, but he's out there. Here I am here, and he's out there like the sun. And you all, like the planets, are out there, all revolving around me. Because, of course, I am the center of the solar system and the universe. I just know it. I mean, in every inch of me, I know. Where is the center? Let me think. I'll close my eyes. Here. That's where it is. Where else would it be? I mean, what good does it do for me, if God out there somewhere is happy, if I'm not happy? I mean, I'm happy for God that he's happy, but it doesn't do me any good. If I am hungry, it doesn't do me any good for you to eat a pizza. It's just not going to get me anywhere. So I'm at the center of this whole thing, and God and other people are moving around me at the center, just like in the Ptolemaic view of the world, the earth is at the center and the sun and the planets are moving around like so. Okay, well, Copernicus came along and said, well, no, actually, the sun is at the center of the solar system. The earth is a planet just like Mars that you see there or Venus moving around the sun. It may not look and feel that way when I look at the sky, but that's actually the explanation for what's going on. Well, the two great commandments are like a Copernican revolution in the way that we look at our situation in the world. God, of course, is the sun at the center of everything. I am just another planet, another human being created by God, another one of those planets circling around the sun. So, as I look at things, God is at the center, and these other planets here are a planet like I am. I'm like them. This is revolutionary in two ways. I am acknowledging that God is at the center, not me, so it is changing my perception and relationship to God. But the one that I want to concentrate on today is that second one, is that I'm just one of these planets out here. I mean, it's good to be a planet. Planets are good. Planets are important. But they're not the sun, and they're not at the center. And One planet is not more important than the other. I mean, now, okay, so now my analogy starts to break down because obviously Earth is more important. But what I'm saying is, as a human being, I am accepting this picture of things that I have an equal but not greater importance as a creature of God than anyone else. This is one of the fundamental moral issues of human existence. One of them is concerning how I relate to God, but the other is, how do I see myself in relationship to all of you? Will we accept our place in the world, not above others, but beside them? Will we admit that we are all in the same boat, basically? Equally important, equally needy, equally worthy of respect as God's creatures. This is a fundamental part of what it means to be a sinner, as I would look at it, is why is it that I sin against other people? I sin against God as well, but why do I sin against other people? Well, because I'm most interested in benefiting myself. And if you end up losing when I'm benefiting myself, well, I am the center of the universe after all. So that's just kind of the way it goes. The second great commandment says, love your neighbor as yourself. That is, put yourself in your neighbor's place and ask how you would want to be treated. There's this fundamental sense that the appropriate and right thing is for me to recognize that the needs of my neighbor are just as important as mine. That's a fundamental moral issue in human life, I think. Now, we know, I want to be very clear, we have already failed this test. As sinners, we fall short of loving our neighbor as ourselves, and we continue to fall short. We still, even as believers, we still find ourselves falling short of loving our neighbors as ourselves. Okay, so is that the end of it then? I mean, it's nice to know that I should be treating my neighbor as myself. It's nice to know that I should take my place circling around the sun with the other planets, but I'm a sinner, I don't, so tough. Well, it goes farther than that. There is a principle, a truth in this commandment that we cannot reject. Being a believer is about accepting the truth from God, saying, God, you're right. I may not be able to get where I would like to be right now, but I believe you that that's where I ought to be. This is the way things ought to happen. So that truth, that essential sense that my neighbor and I are equal in importance. I'm not more important. My neighbor is not more important. We are together creatures of God who have an equal dignity, an equal right to be treated with respect, and so on. There's an equivalence. What applies to me applies to you and vice versa in a kind of a fundamental sense. And being a person of faith means bowing to this truth, learning that it is true, trying to live in the light of that truth. And that means then that if I reject that, if I will not accept that ultimately as a truth, then I'm not just a sinner, but I am an unbeliever. I will not accept the truth from God that is my situation. Okay, so why am I saying all this stuff? I think that is what we encounter when we come across the issue that Jesus is bringing up in this passage. There is this equivalence here. Do not judge lest you be judged. There is some relationship between how I am dealing with someone else and how I am going to be dealt with. And it has to do with this idea of whether I will ultimately acknowledge that my neighbor and myself are in the same boat. Okay, so let me then take us through this and explain to you what I think is going on. It starts out with, do not judge, lest you be judged. This word judge is tricky. It can have different senses. It can have different senses in English, and it's a similar situation in the Greek, in the New Testament. Sometimes the word judge can imply merely that an assessment is being made. Sometimes it has the further idea associated with it, that there is an assessment being made and some conclusion. Your sentence is being passed. You know, you either pass or fail this judgment that is happening. And sometimes the word judgment can actually focus on the negative conclusion and sentence passed through that assessment. That is, to be judged is to be condemned. So we find that in different ways in the New Testament. I think it was Paul says to the woman in, I've forgotten where, but he said, he uses the language, if you judge us worthy, then let us join you or join us or something like that. I don't exactly remember what it was that was said. But the idea is, you're going to make this decision. You're going to look at us and decide, are these guys that I want to hang around with or not? And that's a judgment. That is an evaluation, an assessment. Well, obviously, when he says, do not judge lest you be judged, and we're talking about the judgment of God, whether you be judged by God, obviously God is going to judge us in the sense that God is going to, we are going to be assessed, and ultimately our destiny is going to be determined by God. So a judgment is going to happen. But obviously, in this case, what he means is more like lest you be condemned, lest you be judged and found wanting and condemned. And I think the word then means the same both times it is used. Do not condemn lest you be condemned is really the idea, I think. That helps us, I think, deal with a very common confusion when it comes to this. At least when I've talked about this in the past, it is very common for a question to come up dealing with, well, what does it mean to judge? We live in a world where for some people, the worst thing you can do is to be judgmental, to judge other people. But what does that mean? For some people, to be judgmental would be to suggest that that thing that that person just did was not good. That is to be judgmental. I don't think that Jesus can mean that when he says, don't judge. Just for one example, I'm thinking later on in Matthew 18, Jesus says, and if your brother sins, go and reprove him in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every fact may be confirmed. And if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax gatherer. Well, my simple point there is, I mean, we could talk about exactly what all that's supposed to look like, but obviously he is suggesting that we are going to make assessments, that there are going to be situations where somebody is doing something evil, and we need to respond. What are we going to do? He's recommending take that person aside in private, first of all, and talk to them. Well, how could I ever do that if I'm forbidden from the outset to ever evaluate whether something is good or bad? So that, I think that can't be what he has in mind. If we mean by being judgmental to determine what is good in what we do and what other people do and what needs to be avoided and corrected and so on, if that is what it means to be judgmental, then I don't see how anything in the New Testament is really going to make sense. I don't think that's what he means. But what he is talking about is that I would, in some sense, condemn. If I condemn you, I stand to be condemned myself. Okay, so now he's going to use the word judge again, but now it's going to morph a little bit because this word kind of, it has different senses that it can have. He says, for in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. So my first comment would be, we can't take the word judge to mean condemn here. He's not saying, for in the way you condemn, you will be condemned. At this point, he's saying, your standard of measure, how you choose to evaluate the situation, that's the way you are going to be evaluated. And here is that basic principle of equivalence again. The idea is, what applies to the other guy applies to you as well. This is a big theme for Jesus. I mean, we've already seen it several times in the Sermon on the Mount. The first was in the Beatitudes, where he said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." There was that thing. If you are not merciful, you will not receive mercy. That was clearly the implication of what he was saying there. Only those who are merciful will receive mercy. The next place was in the Lord's Prayer, where he made it even more explicit. He said, "Forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors." And then, you may recall, that is the only statement in the Lord's Prayer that Jesus explains and makes a comment about after the prayer. He says, "For if you forgive men for their transgressions, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions." And then you may be aware that there is a very well-known parable, the parable of the unforgiving servant, that is all about exactly this dynamic. There is a servant who is forgiven a huge, impossible debt by his master, and then turns around and refuses to forgive another servant who owes him a little money. So this is a very, very important theme in Jesus' teaching. And I think here it has come up again. It's basically the same issue that he's exploring in all those other passages, at least in part, as we'll see. And then the disciples of Jesus go on to explore the same thing. For just one example, in the book of James, James says, "For judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment." Okay, so I would argue that all of these passages are talking about essentially the same sort of thing. So the kind of judging that he's talking about is to be condemning, unmerciful, unforgiving, to essentially in some way take the stance that I cannot forgive or act in kindness or whatever toward you because that is unforgivable. I condemn you in some way. And he's saying, if you take that stance, then you stand to be condemned yourself. So we'll talk a little bit more about why that would be, but let me take us into this little analogy that he uses to show something of what he's thinking about here. He says, "And why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye?" Okay, so it's always important to kind of recognize and acknowledge. I know that Jesus is like the master of the universe and, you know, and has my destiny in his hand, and if he were in the room, I would fall on the ground in front of him immediately. But we do need to acknowledge that this is funny. I mean, it is supposed to be funny, I think. I mean, the picture of a log in your eye. You cannot have a log in your eye. That is not something that is physically possible. I mean, I guess it's physically possible, but it would take a lot of work to bring about. And we're probably not something we would try to accomplish. Okay, so he's setting up an absurd picture to make a very profound point. And I think there are two things that stand out. First of all, in this situation, there is a log in your eye and a speck in the other person's eye. There is this huge disparity in size. He doesn't say, "Why do you look at the log in your brother's eye when you also have a log in your eye?" Or he doesn't say, "Are you concerned with his speck when you've got a speck too?" I mean, he's saying, "Why are you concerned about his speck when you've got a log in your eye?" And I think, I see this as very equivalent to the kind of dynamic in the parable of the unforgiving servant, where the servant is forgiven a massive debt, but will not forgive the small debt that another person owes him. And I think the idea is the fact that if we have hearts that are honest, we recognize the magnitude of our own sin. That is, here's somebody that has done something, and it's bad. We're not saying it's good, it's bad. But I have lived with myself my whole life. I know very well the kind of person I am, how I have related to God, how I have related to others. So from the subjective perspective, I really ought to be aware that there is so much that could be charged against me. There is so much that I need to be forgiven for. So I think that disparity in size is meant to kind of imply to us, you know, I'm not just saying that when somebody does something evil, you ought to say, well, you know, I have a few problems too. I mean, it's not like that. It's like, no, if I had a clear perception of myself, I would recognize how deep the debt is that I owe to God. And then the other thing that strikes me in this picture is how absurd the situation is, and I'm not talking about the size of the log now, I'm talking about the fact that having a log in my eye, I would be concerned about the speck in the other person's eye. Because I just feel absolutely certain that he picked this analogy because we all know what it's like to get something in your eye. If you get something in your eye, I mean, you have to deal with it. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had that thing happen where you're driving and all of a sudden you get something in your eye. It's like, I can't keep driving. I have to pull over or something somewhere because it hurts. It really hurts, and I can't hardly even see. I mean, I can't. If it were to happen to me right now, if I got something in my eye while I'm talking to you, I would stop and say, excuse me, I'm going into the bathroom. I'm going to try to get this thing out of my eye because it's so obvious and impinges on my understanding so clearly. And yet, he's imagining that I have a log, not just a little thing, but this huge thing in my eye, and I have somehow managed to be more concerned about what's that problem in your eye. I really think that he means it to be that absurd, that the difference in size is because it really ought to be apparent to me, my own sin, and it also is, if you think about having something that big in your eye, how could you ignore that? How could you possibly ignore that? But that's the thing. When I am condemning someone else, I am really fundamentally ignoring the magnitude of my own problem. And it's kind of saying, how could that be? Just like in the parable of the unforgiving servant. It's like, how could this servant who has just been forgiven a debt that was going to crush and destroy his life that he could never pay back, how could he forget that so easily when it comes to the debt that the other servant owes him? So, putting it all together, this is really a powerful image of a willful kind of living a lie. I mean, how could you do that? What he's saying is, in essence, if you are one who would condemn someone else in that way, you have pushed the truth aside. You are ignoring something fundamental about yourself in a way that's almost impossible to imagine. I think that's what he means to suggest. Now, it's not impossible for us to imagine. We do it all the time. We do. I mean, I've made this comment before, but in my own life, it is being in the relationship of marriage that really started to bring home to me the reality of this fundamental injustice in my soul. Because I have literally had the experience of, I mean, whichever way, I don't know which comes first, but, you know, I'm starting to complain about something and really sort of feeling the right to demand that this thing, whatever it is, stop. And I realize this flash of insight comes over me. This is exactly like what I did when I was saying, well, give me a break. I mean, well, you can make a federal case out of this. You know, here I am making a federal case about this exact same thing that Robbie, when she did it, I was making, I got that backwards. So here I am making a federal case about what I did not want her making a federal case about when things were reversed. And, I mean, it may seem kind of small and comical, but it's not. I mean, there's something really serious about that situation from my perspective. And one of the things that being a person willing to see the truth, especially when we're talking about a gospel that is about forgiveness, the whole thing at the heart is about forgiveness, to recognize that, to embrace the idea of my forgiveness is to really admit the truth about my need for it. I need mercy. And so when I condemn someone else, it's as if I have forgotten. You know, I am just as condemnable as that other person. I think that's the kind of thing that he's getting at here. So this is a picture of an impossible to imagine situation, and yet in our dealings with each other, this is what we do. Because we are fundamentally not willing to acknowledge that we are in this together, that we are equivalent. I mean, everything in me says when something is to my advantage, if it is to my advantage to be merciful in a situation, then I will do it. If it is not in my advantage to be merciful in a situation, then I won't do it. The issue is always, how does this affect me? Okay, so I hope at this point I've been clear what I think the essential issue is here. It is a fundamental issue of faith. It is one of those things that we are called to mature into as believers, is to grow in our acknowledgement before God that we are in need of His mercy, which in a sense is to sort of grow in that knowledge of the log in our eye. I mean, it's like, okay, this is getting, I'm becoming more and more aware that that's true. So that when I see other evil people in the world, more and more I'm seeing, it's like I'm looking in a mirror. That's me. It's not good. It's not that not condemning them means I look at that and say, oh, that's all right. That's not a problem. It is a problem. It's bad. They're hurting other people. They're hurting me, maybe. This is not good. But I'm not good either. That's the thing. Am I willing to see that I'm like them? So if I need mercy, then so do they. That's the kind of thing that Jesus talks about over and over again, and I think that's what he's getting at here. That your standard of measure is going to be measured to you. If you think that kind of sin deserves condemnation, okay, great. You got that kind of sin. You're condemned. Or if you're willing to say, mercy triumphs over judgment, then mercy will triumph over judgment for you. Okay, then Jesus moves on to a little bit different take on this image that raises another issue, I think. He says, or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye. You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Okay, so I think he's extending the analogy into a little different issue now. The issue isn't now about whether I'm going to be judged by God. The issue is now in how I am dealing, how I'm responding to someone who in some way is involved in sin. I think this, let me take the speck out of your eye, this is analogous to we all know this situation. I mean, and once again, in my life, I am most familiar with it in the context of marriage, although I also work with people, and I find myself involved in it there and pretty much everywhere. It's that thing when somebody is doing something that you don't like. It's not good. It's not right. Especially it's not right if it's inconveniencing me. But, you know, here's this thing. So I feel called upon to act. I feel called upon to remove the speck from the other person's eye. Here, let me tell you where you're going wrong. Let me correct this situation. Let me show you the way. Jesus doesn't say, don't try to take the speck out of the other person's eye. What he says is, deal with the log in your eye first. And I think what he has in mind here is dealing with the log in your eye is dealing with this first truth that he's talking about, that I recognize who I am. My need for mercy, the very real reality of sin in my own life, so that as I go to then respond to and work with someone who is involved in some sort of sin in their life, that there is a quality to my interaction with them that arises from the fact that I recognize my own problem. In other words, as I go and try to be helpful, I will act in mercy and not in impatience or superiority or whatever. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that here in a minute. But so I think that there are these two aspects to what Jesus is saying. The first part is this idea that he's been talking about in a number of places. Do not be judged, lest you be judged. It is the merciful who will receive mercy. If you don't forgive, you will not be forgiven, and so on. That idea that I have come to, from the heart, acknowledge my need for mercy before God, and thus I see the reality of that need in the world. I recognize it. When James says that phrase, mercy triumphs over judgment, I look at that and I say, that's a good thing. It's even a good thing when bad things are happening, because I have remembered, oh yeah, I'm a bad thing that's happening too. Okay, so that's the first thing, is that idea that I am striving to learn, to understand my need for the mercy of God when I look at other people, that I will come to be, through the process of embracing the truth that God has taught, that I am coming to be a merciful person. Not because I am a sinless person or, one who, when I look at everybody, all I think about is their good. I never think about myself. I would love that, but that's not what the truth is. But I am a person that believes the gospel, and thus I believe that I am a sinner who needs mercy and I'm receiving mercy. So I look at the world and I start to see you through that perspective. And thus we grow in mercy, I would argue, as God takes us through the trials of life that teach us about what our faith is about. And that's one of the things that Jesus is getting at here. The other thing, I think, though, is this idea, this question of how do we deal with each other? The quality of our interaction with each other, this idea that I deal with the log in my eye before I deal with the speck in yours. If I'm understanding this, I may not be, but if I'm understanding this, it reminds me of a passage in Galatians that I think is essentially talking about the same sort of thing, and this is Galatians chapter 6. So here's what Paul says there. Brethren, even if anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, of humility, each one looking to yourself so that you too will not be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But each one must examine his own work, and then he will have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another, for each one will bear his own load. Okay, so the place where I started with that passage many years ago is the puzzling, seemingly contradictory statements here. First of all, you should bear one another's burdens, but each one should carry his own load. So, which is it? What are we talking about there? Well, here's what I understand him to be saying, and in the end, I think he's saying what Jesus is saying. The context here is one where, as I understand it, Paul is talking about how the emphasis on law-keeping among them has a tendency to lead to what he calls biting and devouring one another. That if you become focused on the idea that I am basically showing that I'm a good person who deserves the mercy of God, then you start to think highly of yourself and you compare yourself to other people, and when you see other people messing up, you are impatient with them, and it leads to conflicts and boasting. You know, I've got it right, you don't have it right, and that sort of thing. Instead, what he's saying is they need to live in a way that reflects their understanding of being saved by grace, that God is being merciful and the Spirit of God is working in them to lead them to certain sorts of things, including being merciful. So that's why he says, in that sort of context, even if anyone is caught in any trespass, it's okay. Even if you have the situation where you're dealing with someone who has clearly done something wrong, okay, even in that situation, what attitude should you have? How should you deal with this? How should you respond? Well, he says, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself, so that you too will not be tempted. So your response, there is going to be a response. You don't just walk away and say, oh, well, no big deal. He is saying that there are times when it is appropriate to respond, but that response should be out of humility and gentleness and recognizing that you too could easily do such a thing. Watch yourself in the midst of this. So the response, rather than being a response of competition, of condemnation, of arrogant superiority, I've got it, you know, let me come along and show you how much better I am than you are. Because, maybe I'm confessing too much here, but don't you recognize in that and in yourself? Isn't there something sort of satisfying in pointing out that somebody else is messing up? Because there's this kind of hidden thing there that says, well, and I'm not. Fortunately for me, I have not screwed up the way you are, so let me help you here. You may not say it that way, but it can be very attractive. I mean, I find myself falling into this trap all the time when I'm driving. I'm driving along and somebody, you know, they go through the light or they cut somebody off or they're in the wrong lane, you know, they turn left from from the far right lane or something like that. And I just, you know, it's just like, if Robbie's in the car, I immediately say, well, did you see that person did that? And why am I doing that? It's because I didn't do it. I mean, I'm not like that. I'm not a driver like that person. Well, I mean, that's a kind of a silly picture, but that's a very real thing. If you don't have humility, then dealing with other people's sins can be an exercise in arrogance, self-righteousness, being unmerciful, and so on. Okay, so he says, bear one another's burdens and thus fulfill the law of Christ. I'm going to deal with this person who has been caught in a trespass with a recognition they have a burden. And to the extent that I can be helpful, to the extent that there is something that I can do in humility, not seeing myself as somehow better or superior, but there's something that I can do to maybe help the situation, maybe help them see things, help to relieve their burden a little bit, then yes, that's what I ought to do. Not out of a sense of I have kept the rules and you haven't, but out of a sense of, you know, being sinners is hard, isn't it? Let me see if I can help you here. And then he goes on, for if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But each one must examine his own work, and then he will have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another, for each one will bear his own load. So I think what he's saying here then is, okay, if you think you're something when you're nothing, you deceive yourself. You're going into this situation and you're going to correct the one who has fallen into trespass, but you have this sense that somehow in your arrogance that you're the one who keeps the rules, you've done things all right. Okay, but you're deceiving yourself if you go into it in that way. And especially, I think, part of this scenario is it's so easy to be self-righteous because I didn't do that thing. In this situation, you have fallen into trespass, I have not. I'm up, you're down. I mean, it's just really easy to kind of embrace that idea. So here Paul wants to cut that off and say, no, each one must examine his own work, and then he will have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another. That is, this, we're not grading on the curve here. It's not that in this situation that person happens to have done worse than you did, so that means you get a better grade. It's no, let's forget about this person. Let's just step back and think about myself. What sort of a person am I? What's going on here? And four, each one will bear his own load. And in this case, then, bearing his own load means essentially bearing my own responsibility for my own actions. I don't end up being better because you messed up in this situation. How you're doing is not an issue. It's just where am I? So when it comes to other people's sins, I should seek to bear their burdens by being merciful and humbly trying to help them in whatever way I can. But when it comes to my own sins, I need to be demanding and rigorous and bear my own load. So I think that's the reason that leads to this seeming contradiction here is, well, it all depends on what the issue is. And so in other words, I think Paul could have ended this, first remove the log from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. I really do think that in essence he's saying the same kind of thing. So again, I think there are two issues that we see here. One is that question, am I going to condemn? Am I willing to see in the faults of others the reality of my own faults and my own need for mercy? And then secondly, as I act in the world in dealing with other people's faults, am I going to do that from a standpoint of supposed superiority, or am I going to deal with the log in my own eye, recognizing the many faults that I have, and thus being able to act in a way that is merciful rather than judgmental or arrogant or whatever. Okay, so that's what I had to say about this. If you have any questions or comments, now would be a good time.
Thank you, Ron.
Yeah.
Could you please talk more about how Jesus is using the word hypocrite in verse 5?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the things I wanted to talk about. You know, I have struggled to try to deal with, in this passage, what it is he means by that. There's a history with this word. In my experience, it goes all the way back to when we were in California, and there's been long discussions about this word amongst folks around here. So I think it starts for me with the fact that Jesus refers to the leaven of the Pharisees that he doesn't want his disciples to get involved with. Beware of it. He refers to it as hypocrisy. That is, it is their hypocrisy that you want to stay away from. And a hypocrite, it's this word, hypocrites. Okay, so it is true that at times Jesus will say something like, do what they say, but not what they do, which would sort of imply that the hypocrisy that we're talking about is an active sort of, I say one thing, but I'm really about something else. And he does say that, but fundamentally, I think when you look at the Pharisees, they're not hypocrites in the sense that if we were to look at them and think, you know, they're saying you should obey the law, and inside while they're saying it, they're going, boy, have I got these people fooled. I can't wait to get home and break the law. You know, you need to break the law. No, I don't want to. I mean, keep the law. No, I don't want to keep the law. I want to break it. That kind of overt hypocrisy does not seem to characterize them. And so the argument is made that more generally, the idea of the word is the word to describe an actor, someone who is kind of playing a role. So I have gone back and forth in my mind as to try to explain exactly the sense of it. I think what I would say in this situation is, in seeking to deal with the other person's speck, it seems as if it presents itself as an action that is motivated by concern for what is right and concern for the other person. But in fact, if I have not really come to terms with what is really going on, with my own evil, and thus it's not just about the fact that there's sin happening there, that righteousness is being violated, and it's not just about me reaching out and helping someone, there's something else going on. It's the kind of thing that Paul was warning against. A genuine act of concern for that speck in that other person's eye is going to arise from, not from a place of, hey, a rule has been broken and I need to step in and do something about it, but rather a recognition of the reality of sin in my own life that's very much like what I see in this other person's life, and so the action then is going to be an action that is actually in keeping with the values of God, the values that I say I embrace. I really am acting in pursuit of righteousness and the welfare of the other person because I am acting out of mercy. So somewhere in there, the hypocrisy is the gap between the presentation of what this looks like it's about, whereas what it is really about, and the only way that it could be genuinely about righteousness and the other person is if it were motivated from a place of mercy. That's the best answer I got right now.
Okay, so the role playing is I'm playing the part of someone who's concerned about sin, but it's only playing a role because if I really were concerned about it, I would have looked at it in myself first.
Right. Yes, very. That's good. That's what I'm thinking.
Thanks, Ron. This topic is very timely for me, I feel like, in my life right now. And this question is going to be a little just disjointed because I think what you're talking about is really like complicated. There are mm-hmm. all these
right.
very complicated pieces to it. But I have a lot of people in my life who I feel this kinship with. So I feel like they're my brothers or my sisters because I have a long history with them, things that we share in common, common communities here, other places. But when I think about our core values and commitments, at least at this point, while I'm hoping and praying that those are the same, just like I want them to be, you know, like God's for myself, there are things that make me feel like, I don't know if we're quite on the same page. And so I feel like that introduces a complication with things, you know, when you see something that isn't as it ought to be. If that was happening for people that I feel more, I have heard them say that they are committed to the gospel, that would look a little bit different.
Right.
And so I find myself but the vast majority of people in my life, I have not heard them say that they have made that commitment,
right.
even though I feel this very close kinship with them.
Right.
And so I feel like it introduces this problem of where I always feel like I'm going to have the wrong response.
Right.
I'm going to have the wrong motivation. I'm going to be in some way trying to show them that they're wrong. Mm-hmm. Even if though I feel like, no, I actually care about these people. I just want them to understand like I do or something.
Uh-huh.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it's just this very, it makes me feel like I'm just going to mess up. I'm just going to totally mess up an interaction with somebody because I can't go back to, but this is what the Bible says and we both agree about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I feel like I can pray for them and that's
right.
the best thing I can do.
Right.
But then I have to bump shoulders with them because we do have this kinship. So
right.
I just feel like it's very, very complicated. And so can you address that feeling? Like, can you address that?
Sure.
There's a lot there.
Right. So, okay, I can see if I can get all of the things that went through my head while you were talking. When we think about messing up, we don't really, I don't see the focus in either. You know, Jesus says something similar to Paul about, you know, someone who is sinning, you go to them privately, and then, you know, that same thing of, you know, reaching out to someone. Neither of those teachings really emphasizes a certainty of result as to, you know, how people are going to respond or anything like that. The focus, I think, is on this is what you should be about in the midst of this. When Jesus talks about taking the speck out and so forth, this is the sort of speck taker outer you should be if you're going to do that. But it is interesting that both in Jesus' teaching on this and in Paul's teaching on it, they're both picturing a situation where these are fellow members, fellow believers, fellow members of the church, of the assembly. And so kind of implicit is this assumption that you can call on a certain, at least nominal, commitment to the same things. You know, that I can say, look, isn't this what we're about? So that is a different situation than dealing with somebody that I can't call on that common understanding, that I can't say, isn't this what we're about? Because maybe it's not what we are about together. And then the only thing I can say is, it is very difficult to know how to respond. I don't, when this kind of question comes up, I always say, because what I believe is that I'm not sure that I have 100% made the wrong choice as to whether to say something or not in these kinds of situations, but I'm pretty sure I'm getting close to 100% having, if I said nothing, I should have said something. If I said something, I should have shut up. And you know, I've just that sense of, this is really hard to make those assessments. All I can say is, what we want to be motivated by is doing well by the other person. So I do take into account things like, you know, do I have their ear? You know, do I think that my saying something is something that could be helpful? If I just know this is not, you know, they are not going to take this from me, then that might change my perspective on whether or not I'm going to say something, because, you know, I'm just going to make it worse. And now they're going to be even more committed to that, and they won't talk to me. Is that what I'm looking for? I want to have some sort of sense that I can be redemptive in this situation. So, yeah, I think it does make a difference. I wouldn't dictate it makes this difference and this is exactly what you should do. But yeah, I think you're right. It depends. There are people that I know that if they were messing up big time, I wouldn't hesitate for a second to step in and say, let's talk about this. This is not what we're about, is it? Because I have a reasonable confidence that they would take that from me because they care about that. They care about that issue of what we're about. And then there are other people that I think, well, I don't think I'm the person to, I don't think it's my task in this situation to do anything because I can't really accomplish anything good here. So I'm just not going to step in. But those are hard questions, I think. I mean, you're right, it's very complicated.
Thank you for talking about the thing in Galatians. I've always thought that he was saying, when he says bear one another's burdens, mm-hmm. he's saying tolerate one another's struggles. Mm-hmm. Don't let a person's failures or repeated blunders or habitual character flaws, I'm talking about myself now,
right.
Don't let that be a reason for separation. Mm-hmm. Don't think that because they're collapsing under the weight of their own existence that they're not actually believers.
Right.
Be encouraging, be faithful, be honest, because in the end, they got to live with it. Everyone will bear their own burden, whether that's struggle, failure, or judgment. But that's not what you seem to be taking it.
I think that's a pretty good, I mean, that's not where I would land, but you could probably make a pretty good case for the thing that you're, certainly the idea of bearing is often used with the idea of bearing, you know, bearing up, you know, tolerating, not, you know, that sort of thing. And certainly in this context, that's part of the kind of response that I would need. I was just inclined to tie it to the first spot, which was talking about that attempt to be redemptive. You know, he's not saying, if anyone's caught in any trespass, just bear with them. What he says is, I forget what he says, but he's the...
You who are spiritual.
Right. Okay, so I have this here.
Not you who think you are spiritual, who have declared yourself spiritual, but...
Restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Yeah. So I'm seeking to be redemptive. I'm seeking to be restorative. And I was inclined to see the bearing the burdens there as actually helping the person in this spot kind of stand up again or, you know, get up in the midst of that. But certainly that what you're saying would make a lot of sense too.
And so back to the thing in Matthew, I think it's because I'm suffused in this therapeutic community that we live in, is the actor, I mean, I think I'm seeing more of this in the church, but within the secular community here in Eugene, everybody thinks they're a healer. And that word gets bandied about, like, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that as if their very wisdom and insight and patience and hidden shining glory of their soul mm-hmm. is going to come into a situation and lay on hands and make it right. And I hate people like that. I have a really bad reaction that I just have to sit on.
Right.
Whenever anybody appoints someone a healer or claims to be a healer, or I just want to rip their face off.
Yeah.
Because they're wearing the mask of goodness.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean.
I think it's sort of like that's who he's talking about.
Yeah. Well, that sort of thing that arises out of what seems to be an act of you know, I'm helping is actually
look at me, I'm a helper.
Yeah, it's rooted in a misunderstanding about yourself. I would be willing to accept someone's claim that I'm a healer. I mean, if you understood rightly what that meant, but I would want to see in their life that sort of merciful humility that doesn't say, you know, I am not really a big deal. As it happens, you know, my task in life is to kind of help people deal with certain hurtful things. That can be true, I think. So that's okay, but it's where, yeah, it's that thing that is, yeah, I mean, we're all very good at it. I mean, I have to talk to myself about it. Nobody would call me a healer at all, but I'm a teacher. You know, I get to stand up in front of everybody, and there is a temptation to think, and that's a big deal. That makes me kind of a good guy. And you're not a teacher, are you? Oh, I know you're not. I am. No, yeah, you're not either, are you? Yeah, well, yeah, it's okay. I mean, you know, some of us are, like me, and some of us aren't. I mean, I'm making it sound funny, but that is a spiritual trap that many teachers in the world fall into, is thinking that ultimately they forget. the spirit of gentleness is gone. They think what this is about, really, they have confused, improving my own situation, thinking well of myself, having other people think well of me, they've confused that with the action of actually being redemptive and helpful in a situation. It's easy to have happen. So, yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing that Jesus is getting at here. I mean, it really is. You take the log out of your own eye first, and you're going to be a very different sort of spectator-outer in other people's eyes. I think that's what he's saying. Okay, one more.
Ron, do you have any commentary about the equation in this thing? Is that the description is not
you know, there's a speck in your neighbor's eye, but you got a speck in your eye, so it's not an equal thing. He's saying you got a log in your eye, and that's a little humorous, actually, if you can imagine a guy with that thing.
Right, right.
And, you know, and do you think that was for this, for the effect of making it clear, or was he, because you would think he would have said, his reaction would have been, you know, hey, you're blind.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't say that. He says, hypocrite.
Yeah.
And what comes to my mind is this notion that if you've got a log in your eye and you're going out of your way to help this guy with a speck, which he doesn't seem to have a problem with, he says, wait a minute, take a look at the log first and let's deal with that. But it seems like it's almost saying, well, you're doing that on purpose. I mean, you are ignoring it, you know, whether that's some sort of transference or I don't know what that is.
Right.
But it's deal with that because you're not dealing with it, not because it's not obvious, you know.
Right.
Or is it a commentary about the kind of the human, you know, because it's not about blindness. It's about hypocrites acting and saying one thing, doing something else. I just wondered, you know, because he could have said speck, take this speck, then do that speck. Or he could have said, well, you've got a speck in your eye, but they've got a log in their eye, you know. And that's not how it worked. It was quite the opposite, anyway.
Right. Well, no, I agree. I mean, I think the log and the speck image accomplishes two things. This is what I'm just trying to get across here. Number one, that disparity arises not just from a subjective impression. I mean, take that back. That disparity arises from the fact that I am more aware of my own sin. I ought to really be aware of the magnitude of the problem in my situation. And also, how could you ignore it? If you had a log in your eye that it's so big, how could you not be thinking, I need to deal with this log? And that brings home the double fact that I have a serious problem and somehow I managed to ignore it. I think that's the thing. So it is to have, by the grace of God, a heart that is willing to see, I have a problem. As I see the speck out there, there is a speck. Can I do something to help get that speck out of their eye? I don't know. But the place to start is, I have a problem. And then that is going to affect the way I interact with that. So I think I'm agreeing with what you're saying. Okay, good. Thank you.